We would like to say thank you to our sponsors, Gasogene Books, an imprint of West Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Whether you've just discovered the great detective or you're a seasoned Sherlockian, we're sure you'll find many unique volumes to pique your interest. Go check it out at westexpress.com.
They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. So in Scotland Yard, they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one be mine?
Hello and welcome to the Baker Street Babes podcast. We are on episode 30, which is the big 3-0, which I find really funny. And we're today talking to Betsy Rosenblatt of AO3, which is the archive of her own, and she's responsible for all kind of legal shenanigans pertaining to fun works, and we're very excited to have her here. And also with me are Amy and Benji and Taylor today. Hooray, hello.
Hello. I actually I want to make a little correction, not to be a pest, but I actually am not representing the archive. Specifically, I'm on the legal committee of the Organization for Transformative Works, which runs the archive.
Okay.
But it's just a tiny modification there because the archive is very ably and beautifully run by other people in the Organization for Transformative Works. And while I use the archive, and I think it's a great thing, I am not at all involved in managing it unless those people have a legal question, in which case they come to the committee that I am on.
Gotcha. See, I didn't even know that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think first of all, we always ask our Baker Street Babes interviewees, how did you get involved in Sherlock Holmes? Very important question.
Crucial question, and actually a sort of central piece of identity for me because I was born into Sherlock Holmes community. My parents are both Sherlockians, and actually, to the extent these things matter to anyone, Sherlockians of some note. They're both members of the Baker Street Irregulars, and my mother was actually one of the very first women inducted into the Baker Street Irregulars after a very, very long period of misogyny. So I was sort of literally born into Sherlockiana, but of course there are lots of kids of Sherlockians and not all of them become Sherlockians themselves. And so what got me into Sherlock Holmes was, as much as anything else, the community itself. I love the stories. I'm very, very attracted to the incredible friendship between the characters, the imagery in the stories. But I have to say, when it comes down to it, what has kept me going with Sherlock Holmes and the Sherlock Holmes community has been the other people. You know, going every year to Sherlock gathering of Sherlockians has been as much, I think, about the other people as about the great detective himself.
Yeah, I love that. You were totally born into Sherlockian royalty. They're lovely people. They're lovely people. So secondly, we would like to know what, if any, is your favorite case from the canon?
That is actually something to which I gave some thought today because I knew you were going to ask, and it is not an easy question to answer.
No, it's terrible. Ooh.
No, it's actually kind of a cruel question to ask, but I came up with a couple of answers because my main answer is that I love any story that demonstrates just how close Holmes and Watson are to each other, how much they love each other, and how much they would do for each other. But we need to sort of break it down to favorite stories. So I've got a sampling of three, the Blue Carbuncle, which I think is a common favorite, the Naval Treaty because it contains one of my favorite passages in the canon, which is Holmes's examination of the moss rose. Mm-hmm. And the empty house, because it's not really much of a mystery. It's just a story about these two guys, and it has some sort of interesting legal issues in it, too. So there you go.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I love when Watson says in the empty house, where you like and when you like. It's just, that's
yeah. Beautiful.
He could have punched him in the face and he said, where you like and when you like. It's really pretty. And finally, what's your favorite adaptation?
Well, I grew up, that's not the right word. I think I became familiar with adaptations in the Brett era. And so I am a Brett girl, but I have to say, I think I actually like the BBC Sherlock better. I really like the BBC Sherlock.
It's good.
It's good.
Yeah, it's really good.
And it demonstrates, I think, one of the things that I, particularly when you compare it to the Warner Brothers Holmes, they demonstrate something that I think makes Holmes so special, which is its adaptability. The Holmes-Watson dynamic and this idea of the cerebral problem-solving approach is so adaptable into whatever the pulp genre of the day is. And so, you know, you can turn Holmes into an action-adventure film, you can turn it into a buddy cop movie, you can turn it into a cerebral sort of logic adventure. Mm-hmm. And as a cerebral logic adventure type myself, that then becomes what I'm really attracted to, particularly since what the BBC Sherlock does, and I'm sure I'm not the first to observe this, because it's not told from Watson's POV, you can get a little more into the psychology of Watson and explain things about Watson that you really couldn't get, for example, in the original stories, because he would never be that critical of himself.
Yeah, it's almost as if instead of only reading John's blog, you're watching him as he's writing it.
Yeah. So, whereas you have to infer from the stories why Watson, immediately upon meeting this virtual stranger, is willing to risk his life for him.
Mm-hmm. It's a good job, I think, of showing what Watson gets out of the relationship, because sometimes you miss that in the stories when it's just him talking about this wonderful person, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. Good answers. You're now, what, an honorary Baker Street babe, I think?
Woohoo! I'm honored. I really do, actually. Yeah.
So we're going to lob you a softball for the first question and ask you flat out, just so that you can talk about it in your eloquent fashion, is fan fiction legal, and is fan art legal, and are fan videos that take existing clips that are under copyright legal?
That is, if that's your version of a softball, I want to hear the hard one. The short answer is it depends. There are, of course, much longer answers, but I'll tell you a couple of the things it depends on. One, it depends on what you're appropriating from. So fan fiction, particularly non-commercial fan fiction, is the easiest one. Fan fiction, that is to say, text that draws from the original canon, is straight up legal. There really is, I think, very little argument to the contrary, even silly argument to the contrary, because the original stories, with a few exceptions from the casebook, are already in the public domain. And to the extent that you're writing fan fiction, you're probably not going to be taking very many elements that are exclusive to the casebook. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't even fall into the realm of copyright to discuss. Now, to the extent you're taking elements that come specifically from the casebook, it's almost certainly fair use, at least under United States copyright law. But the reason I say it depends is, first of all, the United States law is not the only law in the world, and different laws approach copyright differently. The United States is one of the very few places, though, where there's any copyright protection for Sherlock Holmes. So maybe the only one, in fact. So, yeah. Again, you're in the clear there. Trademark law is a little more complicated, and that's why the non-commerciality makes a difference, and it comes into play perhaps even more with fan art, if it appears that your fan art has as its source or is in some way endorsed by someone for whom a particular image of Sherlock Holmes or particular elements of Holmes might be considered a source identifier, that is to say, it's their brand, then that could get you in trouble. And interestingly, and this is something I'm actually going to be talking about at the Labor Day weekend conference at UCLA, to the extent that adaptation of Holmes, and in that I include fan adaptation, has any legal problems at all, really they come much more from trademark law than from copyright law. And there's still debate over who owns what trademark rights. Fan videos are even a little bit more dangerous law-wise because there you're taking from things that may actually be protected by copyright. Now I've said all the risky parts. Here's the good news, right? Fair use is quite generous, particularly to non-commercial users of even intensely copyrighted works, right? If a fan vid uses a whole song and it does so in a way that might transform the meaning of the song and it does so non-commercially, there's a very solid argument, and it's an argument that the Organization for Transformative Works is very comfortable making, that that use is fair use of even the song.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the short answer is it depends. The longer answer is yes, it's all legal, but legal doesn't mean risk-free, and one of the reasons that the Organization for Transformative Works exists is to diminish that risk as much as possible. So, you know your platform. Risk means even if you are in the right, your works could still get taken down from some platforms, you could still be this at the end of a cease and desist letter. You don't have to be wrong to be in territory where there's risk. But I think, for the most part, there's very little to stand on for those who might want to argue that any sort of fan work is an intellectual property law problem. Unless you're trying to make a commercial endeavor out of someone's trademark. Right.
Which is not clever business dealings.
No.
And leads me to ask you, how did you get involved with the Organization for Transformative Works, and in what way does the organization provide legal advice to people who are making transformative works?
Well, I got involved, again, not in any sort of, much of the way I got involved with Sherlockiana. I kind of fell into it because I have friends who are dedicated fans and fanfic writers, fan vid makers. I readily disclose my own involvement in fanfic. I write fanfic. I make fan art. Not drawing. I can't draw. But I crochet.
Yay!
So I've written fanfic. I've actually never written Sherlock Holmes fanfic, which is kind of odd for Sherlockian. It just doesn't happen to be the place my fanfic mind goes. Because I had these friends who were actually involved in the very, very early days of the organization, they kind of pulled me in and said, hey, we're doing this really cool thing. You should get involved. It took me quite a while, actually, to carve out the time in my life to get involved. But then I joined the legal committee, and the rest is history. I've been involved since then. It dovetails with my scholarly interests as an academic. Because my academic field is intellectual property work, and I'm particularly interested in areas where intellectual property law doesn't act as an engine of creation. Fanfic mm-hmm. is a great place for that, right? People create fanfic because of community, because they can't help themselves, because they're passionate about it, for all sorts of wonderful reasons that have nothing to do with intellectual property law, which, yeah. to the extent it's involved, actually gets in the way. So my scholarly interest and the interest of the OTW are tied together quite well. So what the OTW does, there's a lot of projects that it has going. A couple of the best known are, it has the archive that you're familiar with, and it does legal advocacy, which is most of what I'm involved with. They also have various projects. There's a journal the scholarly journal about fandoms called Transformative Works and Cultures. There's the Open Doors Project. There are some major archiving projects. So there's a wiki, fan lore. I have left out things, not because I think they're unimportant, but because I don't have them all written down. So the organization does a lot of things. My involvement is mostly in the legal advocacy side, where we, as a committee, provide legal advice to the org, and also fans will come to us for guidance. I hesitate to say legal advice because we're not creating an attorney-client relationship, but we will sort of give guidance to fans, help educate about what's okay and what's not, that sort of thing. And we also are involved, something I'm very passionate about, we're involved in advocacy, which means we give congressional testimony. We write legal briefs. We, I think, would feel quite comfortable representing someone in litigation, probably not ourselves, but working with a law firm to do that and getting a law firm involved. And we've had some success in the advocacy area. Very early in the organization, before I was involved, we were involved with creating a vidding exception to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act's anti-circumvention provisions. That's a lot of jargon. What it means is that vidders can rip DVDs. Other people can't, right? But vidders can. Because they're making transformative works, it's okay to rip DVDs.
That's
because
they're
making non-commercial video transformative works. That exemption is currently being re-examined by the Copyright Office, as it's required to be. This isn't, no, there's no malice in this. This was it was a temporary exemption that's up for renewal. And so we gave testimony in that renewal process, and we are, of course, hoping very much that the exemption is renewed. If it's not, then vidders will be relegated to other kinds of inferior technologies for fine images they want to use, which is which would be very disappointing. So we've been involved with that. We've been involved with anti-censorship litigation and defending the rights of not necessarily fans, because there hasn't been much litigation about fan fiction, defending other sort of related rights through amicus briefs, that is to say, friend of the court briefs, where we're not representing a particular party. Instead, we're helping to educate the court about issues that might be implicated by whatever the court's decision is. So we do that sort of thing.
Now, do you think, is there a difference if someone were to write a piece of fan fiction and they were to post it, say, on the archive, as opposed to on LiveJournal or on fanfiction.net, would there be a legal difference between different platforms?
No. There's no legal difference between the platforms, except to the extent that they may be located in different places in the world. So, you know, if a server is located in one country, the law might treat it differently from whether it's located in another country. But as a more general matter, absolutely not. The law doesn't treat LiveJournal differently from fanfiction.org or the archive. The main difference between those is usability, searchability, and protection. So, you know, one thing that the archive does, I think, very well is aggregates in searchable, readable, usable form some really great fanfic. LiveJournal doesn't accomplish that as well. And also, you know, if you put something on the archive, it's safe there, right? But if you put your video up on YouTube, it might get taken down.
Okay.
But the archive is a sort of safer place because it's run by fans for fans. So that's the, so there isn't, you don't have that sort of fear of censorship on the archive. But that's the main difference, I think, between the archive. And the archive also has really handy sort of tagging technology, so you can identify various traits of your work and you can find other works with those traits. And if someone's looking for NC-17 type stuff, they can find that. If they're looking only for stuff that is appropriate for a more general audience, they can find that. So that, I think, is another neat thing about the archive.
Yeah, the archive.
But it's not a legal difference. It's okay. A practical difference.
Yeah, totally. So this is obviously, like, this is a huge part of your life and of your time. And do you ever find, I mean, as a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, who, some of whom, in terms of demographics, might not necessarily be as familiar with the world of fandom and the world of the interwebs, does it ever feel a bit like a disconnect to you to be sort of on both sides of the Sherlockian sort of, there's not a cultural divide, but there's certainly cultural, you know, miscommunication on occasion. Does it ever feel a little schizophrenic?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a question that I know you and I have talked about before, sort of pre-podcast.
Yeah.
I think there's a disconnect in the sense that there are these two lively, complete, fully realized, fantastic groups of enthusiasts who have almost no relationship to each other on a day-to-day basis. They don't interact very much, and it's baffling to me that that's true. And the reason it's baffling is because, in all other respects, they're so very similar. So the Baker Street Irregulars type of Sherlockian will engage in pastiche. The fandom type of Sherlockian will engage in fanfic. You know, pastiche and fanfic are kind of the same thing. I think there might be a little bit of a sort of cultural difference in the sense that the fanfic community is much more involved in transforming and building upon the narrative, whereas the literary society side of the community is maybe a little bit more involved in homage and pseudo-scholarship.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that those are meaningful differences. They just happen to be the way their practices have evolved, and there's a huge amount of overlap. I think the key difference is demographic, as you pointed out, and the sort of, to be a bit reductive about it, the old white male community isn't maybe as involved in the interwebs, and thus hasn't discovered the richness of the internet fan communities. And I think that's a shame. I think actually both communities could really enjoy meeting and learning from and being involved with the other.
Yeah, here, here.
Oh. Yeah, it's been a very, I've been trying to plan a get-together in Atlanta that kind of aims towards that newer web demographic, and part of what I'm really hoping to accomplish in some way is it's kind of a fan conference thing that would be similar to something like Comic-Con or Dragon-Con, but I'm trying to introduce an element of the more traditional, like, a scholarly discussion of Sherlock to it, kind of hoping to show the younger fans that even though it's more intimidating to be in that academic type environment, that what they're doing is the same thing.
Good. Yes, and I should emphasize here, if you meet these Baker Street Irregular Literary Society type Sherlockians, scholarship is not what you will find. You will find an awful lot of pseudo-scholarship, which I do not say to insult it. It's awesome and it's hilarious, right? It is not, it's tremendously funny, tremendously erudite, but there are also a lot of scholars who do sort of deep, important work on Doyle and Holmes, and they're doing, I think, something very qualitatively different, because they're doing real literary analysis and kind of serious, important, intelligent stuff, and I don't think that anyone would accuse the Baker Street Irregulars of being serious, intelligent, or important.
We're not exactly curing cancer, no.
I think we are erudite and funny and take ourselves too seriously, but that's very different from being serious, intelligent, and important.
Oh, that's true. That's so, as a longtime Sherlockian yourself, as you've said, and being one who's involved in fan culture and in the Baker Street Irregulars culture, how do you feel about how things have changed since the Warner Brothers films and the BBC Sherlock adaptations have happened? Because suddenly, to me, it seems like this sort of niche that I was in that was geeky is like a cash gravy, like a total cash cow. It's a gravy train for Hollywood, for BBC. They're doing very well by themselves in the business of Sherlock Holmes. So how do you have a take on the way both fan culture and, you know, BSI culture have altered since this new explosion of, you know, hordes and hordes of brand new Sherlockians? Well,
I think all of these young whippersnappers should get off of my lawn. I think for the most part, it's wonderful, right? You get people excited about the same thing you're excited about, even if they're excited in a different way. I think that's awesome. They may not be excited about in the same way I am, right? If I want to write a Baker Street Journal article about, the depiction of women's mental states in the canon, right, and make it funny or write an article about how I think that Watson was a time traveler, which I've actually done, but right, those, right, that's when I say pseudo scholarship, right? This is not actual, anyway. So that may manifest differently from people who are getting into it now through these new properties, but it might not. And I think the more people who are excited about these things, the better. Yes, there's a bit of a dilutive effect, but that doesn't bother me. I think the more the merrier. If the more people love the thing that I love, I'm cool with that. I go to Comic-Con every year, and even just in the last 6 years or so, right, because I'm also a comics nerd. I'm a nerd, really. I'm a kind of a pan nerd. I'm super nerdy. But right, even just in the past few years as I've been going for, I don't know, maybe 6 years, Comic-Con has changed from, you know, hundreds of thousands of people to more hundreds of thousands of people. And the people who went to Comic-Con in the beginning when it was just 100 people are sort of panicked, I think, about how different it is. But they're also excited and thinking like, wow, a million people want to be a part of something that I also care about, and they care about things differently from me, but they still care about it. And I sort of, maybe there's that duality, mm-hmm. but I refuse to be discouraged or grumpy about it, because I think it's cool.
So in terms specifically of that caring, of that passionate, intense caring, I mean, not a day goes by I don't at some point think about Sherlock Holmes. Which is kind of ridiculous, but like, it's been that way since I was 10. So I can't apologize for it. I was born this way. So,
Lady Gaga.
So, what do you think in terms of caring that deeply? You write fan fiction as well, and you create transformative works. Do you think that it's true that narratives that have loose ends to them and sort of loose continuities are the most attractive to fan writers? Do you think there's something particular about Sherlock Holmes and John Watson that is magical and that appeals to people? Do you think that there are any particular aspects of literature or movies that draw you to things and then make you want to create works based on them?
So this is a great question. This is one of those meta fan questions that I find really intriguing. And I'm not sure that it's loose ends and continuities that actually make a work interesting to fans, although I think those loose ends and continuities create hooks for transformative works, and hooks are easy and fun. But I actually think that it's rich world building and rich character building that make a work attractive to transformative work creators and fan creators. Because when I am in the Sherlock Holmes world, I feel like if I open up a doorway, there's going to be something behind it. It's not going to be a piece of plywood that's the edge of the scene. Mm-hmm. And so just because Doyle hasn't shown me what's behind that door doesn't mean there isn't something behind there. And it's my responsibility is a very strong word, but it's my inclination as a fan to want to put something behind it, because I know that it's there. It's a real factual feeling world with real factual feeling people in it. And so the existence of that rich world means you're comfortable romping around in it in places where Doyle didn't happen to go. And how could he, right? He could only rewrite a finite number of stories about this world. So it's our inclination to write more and to fill in those little, the interstices that we know are there. So, yes, the gaps and hooks. I think the gaps create hooks for the pseudo-scholarship as much as anything else, right? There's a million articles about exactly how the trajectory of the bullet could have worked to give Watson those inconsistent injuries. That's where the gaps and hooks come in more than in the fictional creation, I think.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people, particularly when I think of, you know, if I picture somebody who is deeply involved in transformative works, this might be reductive, but I think of a 20-something or 30-something female post-grad, generally.
Yeah.
And there's something that really appeals to that demographic, I think, about Holmes and Watson, and about how you said earlier that the love in that relationship, it's just a beautiful literary relationship. And there's something I think that, you know, the Baker Street Irregulars were an all-male organization for a very long time, but I've never met a gentleman who is more emotionally invested in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries than some of the women who are emotionally invested in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, which is interesting. Sure. And creates kind of an interesting gender dynamic when you think about it, but
that's a fair point, actually. Yeah. I think you're right about the demographics of fandom also. I think that for whatever reason, whether it's a question of culture or natural inclination or what, I think that the creators of transformative works and the members of the transformative work community, right? There are lots of men out there writing pastiches, but the women have banded together in a communitarian way around this, and particularly, I think, around the friendship of Holmes and Watson, because they can taste the potential in that friendship, the story potential, the realness of it. And I think that the stories provide something for everyone, not just, you know, postgraduate women. And that's why we have BBC Sherlock, that's why we have the Warner Brothers movies.
That there aren't men in fandom and that there aren't, you know, people who are in their 70s in fandom, that's definitely true too. But if we were to take a poll.
Three of us are between 20 and 30, overeducated, underemployed, and spend far too much time on the internet.
That sounds about right to me, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
In the best possible way.
Yep, that's proper. And, you know, I do think that it is always more interesting to write stories about people who would literally rather die than the other person not exist in the world than it is to write stories about people who are in any way sort of tepid or ambivalent. I mean, that's just, in terms of character development, I think it's much more interesting. A relationship, like, I would take a bullet for you, has always fascinated me in terms of just that dynamic between them.
Yeah. And I think that's something that I get very attached to in other kinds of stories too. I think the Holmes and Watson dynamic isn't unique in that, but it's the one that I glommed onto as a kid, and therefore it's my archetype.
Yeah, totally. Formative years.
Formative years. Absolutely. And it's an incredibly well-realized version of that.
Yeah.
We have to give Doyle credit for creating that dynamic, and creating it instantly, right? Literally hours after they met, Watson was willing to put his life in Holmes' hands, and I think that's very powerful for a reader.
Yeah, there's a love at first sight element there.
Yeah.
Pretty. It's so pretty!
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you just said that Holmes and Watson is your archetype, but you also said that Holmes and Watson is not where your fan fiction mind goes. So what kind of things in terms of fanfic do you yourself like to write or to read or to write and read about?
I'm a big TV watcher. And so my day-to-day input is TV, which is at the front of my mind. And so I will often read and write in whatever I happen to be watching at the time because it's at the front of my mind. I also really like the, I don't know if this is something that you guys are familiar with, the Yuletide Treasures event, which I've participated in the past and enjoy reading, where there isn't really much Holmes unless it's a crossover with a rare source of canon. But I think I like to delve into that because you're getting people writing about worlds that maybe aren't as popular for fans. So that's sort of So it's interesting, right? You raise a very good point that Holmes and Watson are my archetype, and yet they're not where I write as much. And I think that may have to do with the fact that I've already kind of in my head filled in a lot of the coloring of Holmes since I was a kid. And so I don't need to do that anymore in the same way that I do with new media that's coming in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which, yeah, I don't have a great explanation for it.
No, it's just whatever's in the forefront of your head. Yeah, I mean, and also I think that, you know, there's a lot of people who write fan fiction and who write pastiche recreationally, and then, you know, there's other folk who I've spoken with for whom fan fiction is like really just this form of, I don't want to say self-therapy necessarily, but like they feel way, way better. And it's not just, you know, it's not just journaling and it's not just writing poetry about the angst that we all have in our bellies somewhere. But fanfic specifically, and, you know, reading it and writing it, I think for a lot of people, it's an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And really, really, really important in terms of, because I know that when I finished reading the canon, I was sort of devastated. I was like, that's it. That's 60. It's over.
Yeah.
No. It's all over. Why? And then I realized that a bunch of people felt the same way I did and then decided to write more. So, you know, if I were to make a guess at the amount of just transformative Sherlockian works that I have consumed in my lifetime, it would be in the millions of words.
That's a good thing. I think that the other thing is, for me, one of the reasons that I really love reading fan works is I adore encountering someone's experience of a work that makes it mean something different to me than it meant when I read it. And I'm very tied to what Holmes means to me already, so I'm not sure I want other people's conceptions of Holmes and Watson intruding into mine, although I perhaps would be a better person if I did. But one of the things that I love about reading, you know, for example, reading Yuletide works is, right, someone's version of Calvin and Hobbes might completely transform my concept of who Calvin and Hobbes are. And I love that, which is one of the things that I really turn to fanfic for. And one of the things that when I write, I kind of try to accomplish that, right? Someday I am going to write a piece of fanfic about Harold and the Purple Crayon and his sort of existential, you know, like, who knows, right? Like,
yeah.
to take a completely different angle on this, how exactly does Harold get this Purple Crayon? What is the Purple Crayon? And I want to think about those things. And I feel like maybe my concept of Holmes and Watson is a little bit entrenched. Which maybe is one of the reasons why I love the BBC Sherlock so much, is it's shaken that a little bit in the best possible way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are days where, I mean, it's important what people like, you folks at the Organization for Transformative Works, you know, it's important stuff, because honestly, there are totally days where nothing will make me feel better other than, you know, like, and I'm out of pastiches, and I'm like, I just have to read something where, you know, Holmes and Watson would take a bullet for each other, that's it.
Yep.
That's what has to happen. And like, it's, yeah, it's all, it's good work. I appreciate
yeah.
it.
We're almost to 6. I just want to say a big thank you to you and your colleagues for promoting a positive atmosphere for transformative fan works. I'm somebody who started with fan fiction and went into commercial pastiche and back and forth, and I don't know if I ever would have done a full novel if I hadn't had an awesome platform of fan fiction to start with, and just to be able to be part of that community. So I just want to say a huge thank you to you and to everybody on the committee and everybody at the archive for creating such a positive atmosphere for fans. It's an amazing thing, so thank you very much.
Well, for my part, of course, you are tremendously welcome, but I really want to be clear how little credit I can take for any of that. My involvement is so tangential. I am a consumer in the same way you are, much more than I am, much more than I am a creator of these resources. So I actually have the same exact gratitude that you have to the many hardworking people who make the archive and other resources possible.
Well, it's amazing of you to put in your, you know, your legal time to help people who might otherwise be very uncomfortable with creating these things. And that was actually a question that one of us had wanted to pose. Is there a reason that specifically you want to, you know, invest your time in the legal aspects of fanworks? Is it because it's important to you as well, and it's like a sense of community, or is there another motivation?
There's a sense of community that I feel like I'm part of the OTW community, the same way I'm part of the Sherlockian community, in the way that I sort of envy the Holmes fanfic community, because I'm only on the edges of it. So I care about that community, and I also care about the legality and the legal issues, because it's so close to my heart from a scholarly standpoint. They're policy issues that I like to think about, and I tend to believe that more creativity is better. More work is better. More content is better. And I understand not everybody thinks that way. I think there are a lot of people out there who prefer quality to quantity. I am not one of them, because I think that quality is pretty subjective. Mm-hmm. So I think that being part of a community that helps facilitate that quantity, and also happens, coincidentally and fortunately, to create a lot of works of phenomenal quality, how would I not want to be involved in that?
Yay!
Thank you so much for this group of people. The Baker Street Babes podcast, I think, has really accomplished something very special by tying together maybe old-school Sherlockiana and new-school Sherlockiana in cool ways, opening up people's minds, and just being a fun place. I mean, it's fun to listen to. It's fun to know that there are lots of people out there listening to it. You're part of a broader world of cool people. And I'm very honored to have been invited to participate.
Aw, that's 100% our pleasure. You are awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate, and I can't claim to have been a member of the Baker Street Babes from the beginning, but I certainly would say, Artie, I think that you can attest to the fact that we're super grateful for the enormous outpouring of generosity online, and just, you know, our listeners they're fantastic, and it's not something that I don't think Christina expected it to explode quite the way it did.
So yeah, thank you so much for your kind words.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
Alrighty. Do we have any other tidbits? Taylor?
Not really. Don't think so.
Cool. Well, Betsy's off to Batman.
I'm off to the movies.
Works that inspire other works. Batman. Hello.
Batman inspires a lot of other works, that's for sure. And yeah, I think that should be a lot of fun. So thank you guys so much. I'll sign off, but this has been a delightful conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Betsy. We super appreciate it. Have a wonderful Spanish day with the Batman.
Thank you. You too. Have a great evening.
Thank you. Cheers. See you soon.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. The Baker Street Babes would like to thank their sponsor, the Baker Street Journal, the publication of the Baker Street Irregulars. Wow, lots of Baker Street there. Anywho, started in 1946, the Baker Street Journal produces 4 issues a year in the spring, summer, autumn, and winter, plus a year-end Christmas annual. As founder of the Baker Street Irregulars, Christopher Morley said, "Never has so much been written by so many for so few." It publishes essays and scholarship on the characters and stories from the perspective that they are history, not fiction. And let's be all honest, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John Watson are definitely real. But it is also more than that. It publishes reviews, covers pop culture manifestations between film, radio, and TV, there's plenty to talk about, and the Baker Street Irregulars. And you don't need to be a member of the Baker Street Irregulars to either subscribe to the periodical or even contribute your own article. For more information,
go to www.bakerstreetjournal.com. Thank you very much.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you 2 to 1?